welcome back to another episode of the Country House podcast. And we're delighted to have with us Tim Bonner, who's the chief executive of the Countryside Alliance, the organization that seeks to give rural Britain a voice. And we're here to talk about country sports, field sports. And we're grateful to have you with us to help us with this, Tim. And my first question to all of you, but Tim, perhaps if you can pick this up first, is just how embedded are country sports in the culture of the country house?
The country house, the whole leisure activity was built around country sports of one sort or another. Yeah, the houses in some circumstances actually followed the sport rather than the sport following the houses. But in every situation, and wherever you go across the countryside, those great country houses, they always made the best of the sport that they had.
Thanks, Tim. It might be helpful at this point to think about what the different country sports are. So we have shooting, and within that there's different seasons for different birds. We have, like you mentioned, the grouse moors and the partridges, pheasants, woodcock, and so forth. And then there's the hunting with hounds, and then there's fishing, for example. They're the main three country sports?
Yeah, I suppose, classically, that pre-First World War Edwardian period, you would have, the great, those who were well enough off and had access to the great houses would have travelled from August onwards, really. In August, you obviously, August the 12th, the great day, and to start grouse shooting in the north of England. Grouse moors are extraordinarily exclusive because you can't create one. They're only God can make a grouse moor, and they're very limited numbers. The great houses of the north of England, of Yorkshire, up the Pennines, and of course into Scotland and the estates. The driven grouse day is probably the most exclusive invitation, and always was. A back to back driven grouse weekend from a great house in Yorkshire, for instance, would have been the ideal place to be in August. Predominantly then people might well have moved north into Scotland to the great lodges and castles of Scotland, to stalk deer, especially in the Highlands in particular, before moving back in the autumn into the great fox hunting countries of into the Shires, to Leicestershire, and the great centres of fox hunting, where they may have stayed with friends in great houses, hunting boxes, where they kept their horses. There was an extraordinary period in the early 20th century where the centre of the world was in the hunting shires in Leicestershire and the surrounding areas through the winter. And the whole train system and the whole society was based around how you got your hounds and your horses to the meet. And then later in the year, you probably return to your southern estate, and the classic shooting party, the weekend where you shot pheasants, driven pheasants, and with hunting as fox hunting developed in particular, the meats travelled round the great houses of whichever area the pack was, whichever country the pack had.
Maybe Connor can describe what a hunt meet would look like today, in front of a country house, what someone visiting a pub in a village would find if on a hunting day.
Yes, Jeff, a hunt meet might occur in a field, on a farm, in front of a house, in the village square. But what you'll recognise today by hunt meet is the collection of cars and unboxing, because of course the horses have to come many miles many times to get to the meet. But I suppose the traditional hunt meet at a country house is in front of the house, and it makes up popular art today that we see it on placemats, we see it on prints in pubs across the country. And in that way, it's something that people have seen in art, whether they've seen it in real life. But what we've talked about in previous episodes about what you will find on an estate, the gate lodge, the follies, stables. A kennels is also an important building on an estate, and the huntsman will live on the estate as a member of the estate, the locality, and his family with him. And across the country, you'll find the kennels were paid particular architectural attention to them in the same way that stables were treated. So I think of Goodwood has an impressive stable kennel house. And I believe this is now the gift shop. It's of such architectural beauty. And also Beaver Castle has a very interesting kennels with sort of semicircular curved brick walls, which contain the individual yards for the dog hounds and bitch hounds. And then there are individual compartments to a kennels. So hounds will eat in one part, they will sleep in another part, they'll be moved around when the place is cleaned, and the hygiene of kennels is fantastic. They are cleaned and looked after to incredibly high standards. And to understand the relationship of the huntsman with the hounds, the huntsman is the head hound. He is the top dog, and he lives with them every day. And this is something that on a country estate where there's still an active kennels, you will find through the summer months the huntsman and hunt staff exercising hounds across the parkland into the river to cool down, to wash off, and then return to the kennels. So it's really an important part of estate life in the same way that the stables are, and the fixtures in the landscape that we've discussed, such as the follies and the other buildings.
And many of those kennels are still working. Connor mentioned Beaver Castle, certainly Badminton, at Barclay, at Milton, Peterborough. You still have these extraordinary, and they are. I'm more of a sportsman than an architecture, but even to my very basic eye, you have these extraordinary kennels, which were lavished. You know, which had a huge amount of money lavished on them, and when they were created, which showed the value that those houses and those estates put on that pack of hounds, how important they were culturally, and not just the kennels. When we talk about kennels, it's not just where the hounds live. That's also the housing, not just for the people who look after the huntsman and the people who look after the hounds, but also for the grooms who look after horses. So it's a whole complex in which this the centre of this this really important part of rural society where they live and where they operate from.
And within village life on an estate, which people would be involved in the hunt and in hunt meets, and the broader both employment and people riding out with the hounds, what would you find?
So you have a core of people who are involved day to day in looking after the hounds and looking after the hunt horses, the horses which the huntsman and possibly the masters ride. But there's a whole cast of people who are part of keeping that whole thing going. Certainly before the Hunting Act of 2004, a significant part of that were terriermen, countrymen, whose job it was to ensure that the country was looked after properly, that it was possible to cross on horses. So for instance, barbed wire is one of the absolute horrors of the fox hunter. The great fox hunting estates banned it for many years after it was invented, because the wire in hedges is something that the horses could cut themselves on, obviously, and the rest of it. So where there is wire, you the day before a hunting day, you'll have a group going out and preparing the ground, taking any wire out that the horses might cut themselves on, and making sure that they get across the country, the bridges and gates are open and usable. And those people will come, often volunteers. They'll come from all parts of rural society, from the farming community, from gamekeeping community, and from others.
It's really interesting to hear, as someone who has never participated in one of these weekends or in any of the sports, the role that the community and the local village has in field sports. And I'd love to hear a bit more from you about the role that field sports has and has had in both exhibiting traditional country skills, but also preserving traditional crafts, you know, such as dry stone walling, hedge laying, things that, if not for those activities, might not still be around and passed down to further generations today and onwards.
Yeah, certainly. And hedge laying is a classic example. And many hunts still hold a hedge laying competition in February or March, because hedges are fundamental to this rather strange, extraordinary and complex creation that was fox hunting, because it wasn't just about the quarry, the fox, and the hounds that pursued it, but also the country you went across, and the hedge is, you know, the jumping hedges is the sort of ultimate form of the, you know, is the ultimate pursuit of the quarry species. And the hunting really came, modern fox hunting developed around the period of the enclosures, and it was there's some really quite interesting research being done, because originally hunting as land was enclosed, hedges were put in, fences were put in, hedges largely. Initially, hunting actually kept away from those areas where they had this new landscape, and the hunting carried on in the places where you could get across the country, because jumping wasn't part of it. And then in the end of the 18th century, there was people like Hugo Menel started to create this new sport where you actually galloped to the fence and galloped to the hedge and jumped it. And before that, you know, getting across country had been, you know, people didn't really do that, and getting across country was more difficult. Once they started doing that, and the sort of the massive crew had found this adrenaline rush of a pack of hounds on their quarry with a line of hedges and a field of people on horses pursuing that's what created this new, and it was very new. Fox hunting in the scope of history is very modern. Traditionally, if you go back into the Middle Ages and, you know, up to about the middle of the 19th century, hunting with hounds was about deer and hares. So Queen Elizabeth the First kept a pack of deerhounds, staghounds on Exmoor, and hunted the deer on Exmoor, because that was hunting. Fox hunting was something that the peasants did to protect their livestock.
Our viewers will remember from our listeners will remember, if they're viewers of Downton Abbey, the first episode of Downton Abbey was focused around a hunt meet at Downton. Connor, perhaps you can talk a little bit more about how that looks in terms of the link between the house and the hunt.
Yes, Jeff, the hunt is, and the shoot, incredibly important to the country house. And as we touched on earlier, the paintings, the oil paintings that you will see in the entrance hall, in the great drawing rooms across the country, demonstrate how the owners not only held the hunt in such great regard and surrounding themselves with scenes that brought them great joy, showing the countryside at its finest, that this hunt, any hunt, it casts man into a pre-agrarian herd. So it throws open the boundaries that we've built up over the centuries, and it thrusts you back into a sort of open countryside. And one of the most famous examples of this is the entrance hall to Althorpe. So it was in 1733 that the Earl Spencer commissioned John Wootton to paint famous hunting scenes in the county in the entrance hall. So when guests came into this double-hide, beautiful classical space with an ornate ceiling and Ionic door cases with pediments, tiled floor, and beautiful furnishings, the walls are adorned with oil paintings of the hunt.
And of course, there's also that great hall at Badminton, not dissimilar. And I think in a recent Vanity Fair or Tatler photo shoot, the Dukes of Beaufort were photographed in that hall with their horses, which is quite fun. If our listeners want to look up those photographs, it's a wonderful photo shoot of, I think it's the Duchess of Beaufort with her horses in the entrance hall, which is a very beautiful visual example of the connection between the families in these houses and the horses and the hounds and so forth. But we've talked a lot about hunting, but of course shooting is another big part of the Country House Weekend still, because whilst the hunt meets would often meet outside the front of a house, the shooting parties make the most of the house during shooting weekends, don't they? So when I've gone to shooting weekends, or when friends have, you take over the entire house, every room is full, the dining table is covered in food, you have the routine of a shooting weekend. And maybe Tim, you can run through what a shooting weekend would have looked like at the height of shooting as a sport in the Edwardian era, and what it looks like now, and how similar or dissimilar a modern day shooting weekend is to one in the early 20th century.
Yeah, certainly. And I think the difference really that the pack of hounds, even if it was a ducal pack of hounds, certainly now and for some time had been run by subscription. So you sort of paid your levy and you lived relatively locally, or you were from the area, and you turned up on the day to the meet and you had a great day's hunting. But the shooting weekend, the shooting party was fundamentally different, because that was you invited your friends, your family, or from all over the country, and they gathered often for more than one day shooting. So it probably a long weekend, shoot a Friday and a Saturday, see a Sunday. That has developed into what is a very unique British activity. That sort of ritual of the driven game shoot has developed into a really important part of the modern countryside. It's a growing industry. There's huge demand to be involved in it, and it's really interesting to trace that back from the great country houses and the shooting party, the shooting weekends of the late 19th, early 20th century, and a modern, successful industry now, which brings people from all over the world. Which brings people from all classes, which is relatively accessible.
It's worth also remembering that, as Tim has discussed, the driven shooting, the effect this has on the landscape, that when people look over the countryside, they take for granted the small parcels of woodland and the hedgerows and what we think of as the postcard English countryside. But in large part, this is the result of field sports, in the sense that when it comes to shooting, you must have woodland. You must have a place where the pheasant are reared. But also, in terms of gamekeeping, there is a man or a team to look after. On a big commercial shoot, there would be, of course, more than one person involved. And the gamekeeper not only looks after the pheasant, but he's also taking care of the number of vermin on the estate, which in turn leads to an increase, or rather an abundance, of songbirds and other wildlife that would otherwise be threatened and perhaps even wiped out by vermin. And it's only when you go onto a keepered estate, and it's really when a keepered estate neighbors another keepered estate that you appreciate this, you will notice songbirds and wildlife that you wouldn't see in what is otherwise left to the natural course of events. And this brings us back to what we've mentioned on many episodes on the country estate and the family are custodians. They're maintaining the landscape. It's a love of the land, and it's a long-term view. And so that comes into the planning, the planting of the landscape for field sports, but then also in terms of the animals and the birds and all the life that lives on the estate.
That's really helpful, Connor. And also it's helpful to think about the creation of that landscape. We've talked in the past about Capability Brown and Humphrey Repton and others who created beautiful parkland in the grounds of country houses that was made to look natural, you know, with the lake that was often man-made but looks like a natural lake, the clusters of woodland, and so forth, just made to look like it's a natural idyll when actually it was often created. And in a broader sense, we get that in the countryside at large, in the sense not only of the hedgerows and so forth. Connor's mentioned in the past that a beautiful view isn't a view with no buildings, it's a view with no ugly buildings. When you think about postcards of the British countryside, there's often a small mill or a cottage or a grand house. It's not a beautiful view isn't spoilt by our buildings, it's spoilt by ugly buildings. And in the same way, you know, before the enclosures, open land people wouldn't recognize as the English countryside in the way they do now. We recognize the hedgerows and the dry stone walls. We recognize the wooden gates and all these little clusters of woodland that were often planted. Tim, what are your thoughts?
I think Connor made a really important point there about commitment of long-term land ownership and custodianship of land. And, you know, I can think of one estate I was shown in Dorset a few years ago, where the head keeper was 27 and he had a PhD, and they were working on an extraordinary project to bring grey partridge back into the landscape, which had so many benefits for other species. But the bit that really hit me is that they had an employee on the estate whose job was to plant oak trees. You know, that is almost the definition of commitment. You know, you're planting oak trees, which is not for the next generation to harvest. It's the generation after next, or the generation after that. And one of my great concerns, and you know, slightly moving off topic, but I don't think it is entirely, and the because it is a real contrast between those landscapes which are cared for so passionately by families, sometimes by small farms and small farmers, and the modern trend towards land being owned, often, you know, to be honest, there's a lot of agricultural land which is bought and sold for the purpose of avoiding inheritance tax more than anything else, with an entirely short-term view, farmed with a short-term view, which is almost always bad for biodiversity. But with no concept that there are generations ahead who, from your family or from your community, who need to benefit from that. We live in a created countryside. We need to be very, very honest and open about this. This idea that, you know, this is all just natural and we're best if we leave it alone is a really dangerous one. And it's those estates and those farms which have been in long-term ownership, where families are taking custodianship over generations, they're the ones where you find the British countryside at its finest, and they're the ones who are, you know, continuing to look after the countryside for the benefit of all of us.
You mentioned, Tim, about the generational aspect, and I was thinking about, I was actually, you mentioned Leicestershire as well. I was shooting in Leicestershire at the end of the season in February, and there was a loader on one of the pegs who was 87 and was a keeper at the neighbouring estate. He was over at Milton. You mentioned Milton, the home of the Naylor Leylands, and was the Fitzwilliams family. He's seventh generation working for the Fitzwilliam family, still working at 87, not because he has to, but because he loves to. And not only does he love, you know, this is a lovely guy called Keith. If our listeners go onto our Instagram page, they'll see a picture of him. And I posted a little story about him on our Instagram page, because not only is he, does he love what he does, but he talked about the blessings of working for a great family. He talked about how those seven generations that came before him were all housed and schooled and fed and shooed and all these other things. And he said he has never met a kinder or more noble family than the Fitzwilliams. And it's his honour and his privilege to work for them and live on their estates. And it's a wonderful idea of continuing. And of course, he gets his cottage on the Milton Hall estate is a lifelong lease, which he doesn't pay for. You know, he can live his best country life now, on the estate and going on local shoots, and still helping out with keeper duties. And it's really encouraging. And it might just be helpful for our listeners to imagine a little bit about how the house plays a part in that shooting weekend. So you might arrive, say, on a Friday night. If it's just one day shooting on a Saturday, you'd have a dinner, maybe an early night, sometimes not, in the dining room, fire crackling and so forth, beautiful paintings of sporting scenes and family portraits. You might then get up early the next morning, or relatively early, for the first drive. And before that, you would have breakfast, maybe bacon butties or a traditional English breakfast. You go out and do a couple of drives, and then you have elevenses when you park up and have a, well, maybe you Tim, you describe it.
Shooting pheasants isn't actually, if we're honest about it, it's not the most athletic activity, but it does tend to involve quite a lot of eating and drinking. So as described, it seemed to be impossible to go out on day shooting without having a very large breakfast. And after a drive or two in the morning, there's a stop in the middle for further refreshments. It'll be a light drink. We don't want to drink too much when we're shooting. A good lunch is obviously needed then after a couple more drives. It's a slightly created ritual, because I think if you go back to my grandfather's day, my great grandmother was actually an extraordinary shot, which was very rare in those days. But I have her game books, and I have her husband's game books. She was married a couple of times, but in those days, the sport was probably taken more seriously. I think they enjoyed themselves at the beginning and the end of the day more, but they tended to focus more on the activity. But this activity of driven game shooting has become a really significant part of the rural economy, frankly. Now it's probably the third biggest industry in the countryside after farming and tourism.
And just thinking about the role of the country house within it, Tim mentioned at the start about how many of these houses were built around or as a result of the hunting or shooting in the area. You know, many of these houses were built as shooting boxes and so forth. And it's true, even today, when you think about a house with, say, 20 bedrooms, there would have been no other reason, unless it was vanity, to have built a 20 or 30 bedroom house, unless it was for hosting shooting weekends, for example. So I was talking to a friend just two nights ago who has a beautiful house in Herefordshire, and she said it was built in the late Regency period as a place to entertain guests doing field sports and country pursuits. And even now, that's the only time when that house is filled with people, is on these shooting weekends. Most of the time, most of it's boarded up and not used. But when they have a shooting weekend, every bedroom is inhabited. The dining table is fully occupied. All the fires are lit. The house is full of life and music and chatter. And that's what these houses are for, and built for. And so it's helpful. But I think, Tim, I wonder if before we finish off, we can talk about perhaps the holy grail of the countryman, which is the MacNab. Maybe you can tell us a little bit about what the MacNab is, and have you ever done it?
Well, we're moving up in the world, really, into the Highlands. And we've discussed a lot about the sport of the English countryside, more than the traditional lowland sports. We've touched on others, but especially in the Victorian period, it was actually Prince Albert who started to popularise the Scottish Highlands, his exploits stalking deer at Balmoral started to get people to think about this great chunk of Scotland up in the Highlands, and then there is a whole, people better here to explain it than me, but there's that period of building these great lodges, larger and smaller, across the Scottish Highlands, and you went in August, September. You packed your bags. There's a famous painting. I sadly can't remember who painted it, but Connor may well be able to help us, of the station at King's Cross with everyone lined up ready with their pointers and their guns and their dogs, ready to head to the Scottish Highlands. and the three great quarry of the Scottish Highlands are the salmon, the grouse, and the red deer. And the great challenge is in one day to take a salmon, a brace of grouse, and to stalk a stag. And doing one of those things in a day is quite challenging in many places, but doing all three is something that not many people have knocked off. And I have to admit, I've certainly not achieved that one.
And just as a note to our listeners, that the painting Tim has mentioned is called Going North by the artist George Earle, and it's from the 1890s. And in addition, to get a feeling of the shoot on the country estate at the turn of the century, to watch the film The Shooting Party from 1984.
And Going North, I love that painting. I think it's got quite a humorous juxtaposition between the quite grand, lofty train station and everyone in their gear with their equipment and the hounds on the leads. So people should definitely look that up to get a good picture of it. But in closing, Tim, you said before that it was accessible, and I thought a good way to round this off would just be a final note on, if people are listening or interested, what would you advise them on getting involved, not just in the sports, but in playing an active role in their community in the rural areas? What would you advise?
Well, in terms of hunting with hounds, it's an incredibly open and very easy activity to view, certainly to have the fringes on. As we discussed earlier, you need to be brave, stroke stupid, to cross country behind a lot of packs of hounds. It's not the safest activity, put it like that. So, but your local pack of hounds and the Countryside Lance are certainly happy to help you, put you in contact with them, or the British Hound Sports Association would be as well. Your local pack of hounds would welcome you to a meet anywhere. And Connor talked earlier about the meets of the great houses. They're known largely as lawn meets. They're sort of special dates in the hunting diary, where you go to a large house. And when they hand round the sausage rolls and the pork, it's not just those on the horses who get them. So it's well worth a visit, and you may well be able to you may well see places and countryside which you wouldn't see from any other in any other circumstances. And you can follow in your car. You can run after them. A bicycle's a good way as well. You won't get quite as close to the hounds as if you're on a horse, but certainly it's open to all, and they'll all be very welcome to have you along. Shooting, the best way of getting involved in game shooting is to volunteer to go beating, and it's a really healthy activity. It's great fun. The beaters walk through the woods and then push the pheasants over the guns. You get you'll probably get 25 quid a day, soup and a sandwich. Meet some lovely people and enjoy yourself thoroughly. And if you turn up often enough, the last day of the season, most shoots is the beaters' day, where the guns should turn up and do the beating, and the beaters get to do the shooting. So there is an exclusive, there's a sort of perception that these activities are exclusive. In fact, they're incredibly open and welcoming.
Brilliant. Well, I certainly will. And Tim, we greatly appreciate your time today. Thank you very much. And to our listeners, thank you also, and see you next time. Goodbye.